Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Turn the Page. I'm your host today, Jen, and I'm here with an author who's joining us for the second time, and I am so, so excited. Could you please introduce yourself and the many, many books that you have coming out this year?
Sure. My name is Lev Rosen. I sometimes write under LC Rosen, and I'm the author of books for all ages, most recently Lavender House, but this year I have three books coming out, Lion's Legacy, The Bell in the Fog, and Emmett. And those are all different, you know, two YA, one historical adult mystery, but they all sort of have this theme of playing with queer history.
It really is a beautiful collection, and they all do, well, I haven't read Emmett yet, but I'm going to assume that they all do explore queer history, yeah, and the ways in which it has been, I think, erased and sort of like rediscovered over time. If we could start with Lion's Legacy, because this was so much fun. And I so rarely read things and I'm like, instantaneously, I'm like, I want to watch like 8 movies set in this world, you know, but well, I did with this one. You're welcome. Could you talk a little bit about Lion's Legacy and, you know, maybe how that book came to be, because it plays with archaeology and, as you said, queer history and teen relationships. And there's just so much cool stuff going on.
Thank you. Yeah. So the idea for Lion's Legacy was one I had in my head for a while in different ways. Like I love Indiana Jones. I love that stuff. I am very sad about the recently canceled National Treasure TV show, which was insane but delightful. Somehow it had all the energy of a Nick Cage movie without Nick Cage being in it.
That's amazing, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. But I wasn't sure what the approach would be, really. You know, like, first of all, there's so much that's problematic about the way that Indiana Jones like actually approaches archaeology. And we know about that now. And we know like about how museums in many cases are thieves, stealing, you know, treasures from native peoples. And I think that I was looking for a way in, because certainly, you know, you could do like Indiana Jones had a kid with one of the various women in a country that he visited and stole an artifact from, and she tries to get it back or something. But that didn't feel like my place, you know, as a white dude to write. And so I was trying to figure out a way in for a while. And it wasn't until after I'd written Lavender House, which was a historical queer mystery, that I was like, you know, we have all this history. I bet we have history that goes back further, and that would be a potential way in. That would be interesting. What would it be, you know, to have a sort of Indiana Jones figure trying to reclaim queer history specifically? And then the question, while we're dealing with all this ethical stuff, of like, who does queer history belong to? Because so often if it's taken by traditional historians, the queerness can be completely erased, you know, this or ignored, explained away. You know, you see all this. What's the meme? They were roommates. So you know, you see that all the time, like ancient Egypt, and it's these two women were buried together. Here's a statue of them. These statues were almost always just of married couples. This is the only one where it's two women. So they must have been good friends. Yeah. You know, it feels like they're going out of their way to sort of ignore the obvious implications of that. And that to me was interesting and felt like a way in. And once I had that way in, it was just a matter of sort of figuring out what bit of queer history I wanted to play with and writing the adventure of it.
It's so much fun. And I really do, love the way that you have opened up this this way to explore queer history and to do it serially if you were so inclined, you know, because like the very nature of the source material too is that this is a kind of like adventure-based storytelling, you know, and you can have like a number of adventures as you look for a number of artifacts. But it is all complicated by all of these discussions of, well, when we find these things, what do we do with them? You know, like where, who do they belong to and how do we use them? And that is really important. I think what you've said also touches on, you know, why we do need diverse representation, like in archaeology itself too, because like whether it is through like an intentional suppression or just like the blind spot of a very, I guess, heteronormative like archaeologist, like that's like a, it's a methodological weakness, you know, like it makes your work less good if you think so narrow-mindedly, you know. And so like, do you hope that this will inspire young readers maybe to get into these fields and to care more about this history?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. That would be amazing. That if I ever in the future get like an email or something or from someone being like, you know, I'm queer and I became an archaeologist because of this book, I will be so thrilled. You know, I talked to a real life archaeologist while writing this to sort of get a sense of how they're, you know, obviously most of them aren't like diving into secret temples and solving puzzles and stuff. And I wanted to sort of acknowledge what a real archaeologist would be doing, or at least have knowledge of it. And one thing she told me is, you know, so many people in the field got into the field because of Indiana Jones. Like, they're all sort of embarrassed of it now because of how problematic he is. But at the same time, there is this like overwhelming love for him among archaeologists. And so that, yeah, the idea of being able to play with that archetype, which I feel like he has become at this point, you know, the adventure archaeologist. And even, I don't think he was even the first. I bet we can go back and find sort of a precursor in Victorian times. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and there's a cartoon now that's essentially a spoof of him on Adult Swim or something. But the idea of being able to take that archetype and be like, okay, let's you know, let's queer it. Let's play with what it is to be that archetype from a different point of view, from a different perspective, from a different culture that has a more personal connection to this history, to these objects. That to me is like so exciting. And I really, you know, what I would really love to see is more people writing books like this from different perspectives. I would love that. And you see it in middle grade more often, where it's a bunch of kids sort of finding an old relic. But I'd love to see like actual, like, I'm doing this because I love archaeology, not sort of kids stumbling into mythology stuff. I don't know. It's a weird sort of fuzzy barrier there. But yeah, it'd be thrilling. And to your point about it being able to be serialized, there is a sequel out next year.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I would love to know about how you chose the relic and the sort of the history that's at the center of this one. Because absolutely fascinating. And I feel like very ashamed as like I trained as a historian before I got into libraries and I didn't know about this. And that's very damning of both me and like the many schools that educated me along the way, you know. So could you talk a little bit about, yeah, the history and like the objects that you kind of have made associated with it? Like, how did you encounter this history and how did you decide to work it in here?
Oh man, how did I encounter the Sacred Band of Thebes? That's the history in the book. Is the relic they're searching for are these wedding rings, which I completely made up, of the Sacred Band of Thebes, which is a completely real ancient Greek army of gay couples, essentially. And how did I encounter them for the first time? I genuinely don't remember. Like, I feel like I've known about them off and on since, I don't know, high school or something. You know, it's one of those things, especially being sort of a mythology kid growing up and, you know, so having an interest in ancient Greece and all that. And being queer, certainly these are things I'm always looking at, but I do not remember specifically when I was like, whoa, we had an army. Oh man, now I wish I did remember specifically. But it's always sort of been, and I've taken many queer history classes. I took them in college, so it could have been there too. But, you know, I didn't know much about them. I just sort of knew they existed, like this, you know, this army of gay couples and, you know, their love for each other, you know, there were Greek philosophers who sort of like, I'm going to get this history so messed up. But there was a Greek philosopher who like theorized that such an army would be unstoppable because the love that people would have for each other would make them stronger. And then the army actually came about. And so, you know, I don't know if it actually was stronger, but they did pretty well for a while. They were, you know, they were a very powerful army for a while there. When I was doing the research, there were a lot of places I turned, but there was a recent book out. What was the title of that book? I have it in the author's notes, so let me pull up the author's note. Let me see. Ah, here we go. James Rhamd, The Sacred Band, 300 Theban Lovers Fighting to Save Greek Freedom. That was my primary source, I guess you'd say. Although, truth be told, you know, I didn't feel a need to go super deep into the history of the band and the construction of it. You know, I mention it. There's like, you know, he talks a little about it. But I thought I really didn't want it to become a history lesson. So I want it to be an adventure novel with some history in it that inspires teenagers to be like, whoa, this is my history. This is queer history. This is an aspect of history I don't know about. I want to find out more. That was more my goal than actually like attempting to write a YA version of the James Rhamd book. So I did the research and I knew the research, but I did not put in nearly anything close to, you know, the amount of stuff I learned because I was so focused. And I made a lot up too. It's a funny game sort of being like, look, this is history. I had to figure the rule out before I finished the book because I felt like I was playing with too much stuff. I was like, okay, what's the rule? And the rule I decided on was the history is true, the relic is fake, and everything involving the relic is fake, but inspired by the history. And so that's really where it all sort of came from. So that way I got to have these temples and, you know, these puzzles and the magic and the rings, without ever sort of, I hope, insulting the actual history.
I mean, I think you walk that line really well, you know, and I think that like the way that you approach it is actually like really the best way if you do want readers to end up interested in history, because it's like an interesting kind of backdoor way, you know, because I think that once I'm not, you know, this works on me too, but like once I know the book is trying to educate me, it starts to feel like work, you know, and like, but if you can just spark the curiosity that makes the reader then go and check it out on their own, like that is just as well. And then it's like self-initiated, you know, and it's like, it's a little bit of a subtler way to go about it. I dig that.
And that's, you know, and I tried to do that essentially with Lavender House and with the follow-up Belle in the Fog as well. You know, there's all this queer history in the 50s and I did lots of research and I know all about it and it's very exciting. But I tried to, you know, you want to focus on the story first and the history has to come second. The history has to sort of support the story. But the moment you feel the reader feels like it's not about the story anymore, I think that's when they're gonna not be as interested in what's happening, unless, of course, they're reading for the history. But then they should just read these history books that I put in my author's notes saying that, where I did all the research. These people are, the historians that did the research are much better at that than I am.
Well, that's a great segue, I think. So let's talk about The Bell in the Fog 2. Lyne's Legacy is the first in a series. This is the second in a series, in a different series. And I loved the first in this series, and I loved this one too. So could you remind our listeners who Evander Mills is, what he got up to in the first volume, and what he's up to here?
So Andy Mills, Evander Mills, in the first book, Lavender House, he starts out as a cop who was just caught in a raid on a gay bar. He's a cop in 1952 San Francisco, and he's caught in a raid on a gay bar and of course fired. And he is contemplating suicide when a woman sits down next to him and is like, "I know who you are, I know why you were fired, and I want you to solve the murder of my wife." And he ends up being brought back to the titular Lavender House, which is a sort of gilded cage for this queer family, where inside everyone sort of gets to be who they are, but they have to perform for the outside world, a heteronormative world, family. So even though the dead woman and her wife have a son who is gay, he is married to a woman who has her own girlfriend. A lavender marriage, which was a thing that happened back then to sort of preserve identities. And over the course of this novel, aside from solving a murder, he sort of learns more about what it might be like. You know, he's been separating his life into two things for so long, which is sort of anonymous hookups at the gay bar and, being a cop where he is only half a life. That's what I always say. It's two half lives, but no full life. And he sort of figures out what a full life might look like by watching this family and watching these people. And by the end of it, he's given an opportunity to set up essentially a gay detective agency. And at the start of book two, a few months later, he has taken it, but he is not having much luck getting work because everyone knows he was a cop. And the queer community doesn't really trust a cop with good reason. So he's been trying to get more work, but the only work he's been getting is sort of sketchy tail jobs where he finds out someone's boyfriend has a wife, stuff like that, that he doesn't love, and which the guy who he is interested in, the bartender, at the bar, which is underneath his agency, the gay bar, really doesn't like, having once been a victim of blackmail. And so things have sort of been stagnant for a few months, and he feels like he's letting down Elsie, who's letting him have the space for a percentage of his earnings. And he finds out that, he's really a poor investment, essentially. And then he goes into his office one day, and sitting there is an ex-lover from the war. And this is not just an ex-lover, but this is a man who was sort of his everything, his best friend, his lover, and vanished one day towards the end of the war in a way that I think broke Andy and made him into the person we encounter at the beginning of Lavender House with these two lives. Because by the end of World War II, being queer, they were essentially hunting down queer people within the military. And if one of you went missing, it meant that they were probably going to be interrogated, forced to name names. It was very scary. It was the Lavender Scare. It was the beginning of the Lavender Scare. And so when he vanished with nothing, Andy sort of fled and tried to hide amongst the police. And now this guy is back, and it turns out he just left because he wanted to. And so there's a lot of sort of remembered feelings and, anger. But also he needs the job. He needs the money. It's a good job. So he takes it. And this job takes him into sort of memories of what it was like being queer during World War II, but also into the gay scene of San Francisco in the form of various gay clubs. So we get more of Andy's past and more of San Francisco, and we're sort of leaving that Locked Manor Agatha Christie vibe behind that we had in the first one, and going for more of a noir sort of whodunit. And yeah, it was a lot of fun to write. It was a lot of fun.
It's so much fun to read too, and it does do a lot of interesting things that I feel like the first book we talked about does too, where it does like uncover a lot of really important queer history, especially in San Francisco, you know, because as you were talking about the first book too, I was thinking back on that one. And, you know, obviously today we think of San Francisco as like being on the forefront of gay rights and sort of where people can live openly, but it wasn't always like that. And actually, when you kind of erase the history, it's easy to kind of forget that like it took people to do that, right? Like it didn't just naturally occur, but like people made that happen. And so you get to explore, I think, with the Navy scenes and with the queer club scenes, both like the challenges that stood in the way of that San Francisco evolving, and also like the people who are going to be the main actors in making that version of the city happen, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It and yeah, it's so interesting. You know, you think about both these books together, and then Emmett also. I have these, so much of this stuff going on is sort of about looking at queer history and trying to make it not just, you know, out there, not just exposing it to people, but making it sort of fun and genre and just something that people could pick up and read. You know, I want it to feel almost normal in some ways, but at the same time, I know what I'm doing has a certain isn't normal yet. But certainly getting to write about these, you know, getting to write a mystery and he's going around these gay bars in the 50s, like this is something that conceivably could have happened. Each of those gay bars in the book is inspired by an actual gay bar that was in San Francisco in the 50s. Obviously, I fictionalized it, but you know, this is our history. And the fact that, you know, queer people are constantly sort of born and don't know that we don't know that this is our history, that we have this history, is something that is isolating, I think, for a lot of queer people. And so by making it just another genre book, not to downplay my own work, but on some level that's what I'm going for. It's just another mystery. You know, that makes us more aware of that history. It, you know, it hopefully that it shouldn't be exciting 10 years down the line. Oh yeah, another gay mystery, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's very fun, and I think it does, to touch back when we talked about before, like you do learn a lot, but you don't really feel like you are, you know, because it is normalized in this way. I would love for you to talk a little bit about using the figure of the PI in order to investigate the lives of queer people, because, you know, it occurs to me that like a PI is just a great character for investigating the lives of like anybody sort of like marginalized by society or by the powers that be, because people tend to go to them when they are desperate, when they don't have the resources to go to more legitimate, quote unquote, big air quote sources. So yeah, like, do you like, did you find that using Andy as your main character, like, does it let you explore things perhaps that like you couldn't with another kind of character?
Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting question. I think that certainly having a PI, you know, let me talk about it in juxtaposition to like Lyon's legacy, because then we have two different characters exploring two different sort of aspects of queerness, secret, you know, secrets almost of queerness, secret history. With Andy, I think what's great is that he is of the time as well, which means he gets to go around, he gets to see these people, he gets to talk to these people, and it's his job to sort of get in their heads. You know, they're Agatha Christie always wrote about her detectives as being sort of psychological detectives. They weren't necessarily going around being like, where's the clue? What's, you know, these fingerprints mean this. They were much more interested in the people and how they thought and why they, you know, if she caught, if the they were caught in a lie, why they were lying. And that is the vein that I saw Andy in. He does collect clues, but it's not nearly as extensive as talking to these people and figuring out who these people are. Whereas the more archaeological sense of discovery, so with 10 in Lion's Legacy, is more about sort of exploring the things that came before us. And, you know, he is not of the time, but he is trying to connect to it in a way that I think is so personal and important. And it makes the discoveries and the things he's exploring more intimate almost, whereas with Andy it's intimate because of the people, if that makes sense. So Andy is someone who takes in a cast, whereas Tennessee is more about connection with something that came before him. Mm-hmm. And those are both, to me, really interesting ways of exploring queerness, because on the one hand, you know, I want to examine these people. I want to see how queerness affected each individual person in the past. But I also, as a contemporary person, like, am striving to connect with that queer history in a way that makes me feel like I'm part of something. And so I guess I hadn't really thought of it before, but that does sort of break down the sort of ways I interact with my own queer history, which is just like thinking about the people or thinking about myself as a member of a community.
That's super interesting to me. Yeah, because I think for many people, including myself, it sort of is like this. It's an internal journey, but also like a very external one too. And that is about connecting with other people and with the past and previous generations. And I think, you know, that's really kind of like a double-edged sword for Andy in a lot of ways, because a lot of the past that he has to encounter in this story is really painful and really like something that he's, you know, is struggling to do almost against his own will, because as he said, he really needs the money from this job. Oh gosh. One thing I'm really curious about, and I guess it applies to writing, I guess, series in general. But what was really impressive to me about The Bell and the Fog is that, obviously I did read Lavender House, but if I hadn't, I felt like I could have entered the world in this book and like known enough, you know, in order to like know who Andy is and what his, you know, journey is about and everything like that. So how do you balance, you know, keeping the old readers, but also welcoming the new readers in? That seems like a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, well, thank you. My editor will be thrilled to hear you say that, because I did not even realize that that was a possibility going in. You know, I am one of those people who, if I hear about a series I'm interested in, I will go back to the beginning. I will read from the start. And I just sort of assumed that was everyone. And, you know, my husband, a librarian, is the same way. And he was like, yeah, you just check it out. What are you talking about? So I assumed that's what it was. And originally, the first draft, like, there was not much recap. There was not much, you know, explanation of who these people were. And my editor stepped in and was like, okay, first of all, some people, you know, it may have been a year since some people read the first one. We got to remind them. Second of all, some people will be starting with this one. And I was like, I don't believe that. I fully was like, I don't believe you. I think you're crazy. And she was like, no, it happens. I promise. And so we had a lot of conversations about what I had to sort of make steady. Like, essentially, what she told me was, what's important not necessarily is what he did in the past. What's important is the relationship he has with the people who were in the first book, which are Elsie and Jean, and his relationship with how he got to where he is. And that was the stuff that she really wanted me to sort of recap and make sure it was understandable to people picking up this one first. And so I'm very pleased to hear that I succeeded at that, and she will be too. But that was definitely something I had to be taught.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting, because it does seem really hard, you know, like.
Oh, it was so hard. And I'm doing it again. You know, there's a third book out next year, and I'm starting on that. And I'm like, what do I do again? How does this work? What's going on? I don't
Yeah.
remember.
I guess if it were TV, it would be sort of like the, it would be the, you know, previously on Lost, you know, but that's so you're just
Yeah.
incorporating that into the narrative.
Somehow.
Well, before we wrap up, let's talk a little bit about Emmett, because I haven't read this one yet and I am very excited to as soon as I can. But can you tell us what we can look forward to with this one?
Yeah, so I have like a yearly narrative here, and I'm going to go over. So Lion's Legacy, our Indiana Jones YA, is about a contemporary person exploring their own queer history and trying to connect with what queerness has been through the past and how it's been erased. And then, Belle in the Fog is a queer historical mystery where we see what a queer community would have been like from the perspective of someone just joining it in the past. And then we have Emmett, which is a contemporary retelling of Jane Austen's Emma. And so what it is a queer contemporary play with a story from the past. So they're all sort of playing with how queerness intersects with the past, whether it's trying to dig it up or trying to figure it out or trying to reshape it. And so it's a lot of fun. It is a romantic comedy, with all the sort of did you like Clueless? Did you wish it was a gay man? Do you wish it were the place today? You'll probably like this. But the big twist I gave it, the reason I wrote it and I did Emma is because I love Emma, because I love that Jane Austen quote where she was like, yeah, I'm gonna write a character everyone hates but me. And I was like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
And I think I did. Like, Emmett is insufferable, and I loved writing every minute of him. But the big twist I give it is that Emma originally, is trying to set up this girl, her friend, who is of a less advantageous social background. And in Emmett, he is trying to set up his friend with benefits because his friend with benefits has caught feelings and Emmett has no interest in a relationship. So it's very messy, and I'm very pleased about that. He's just so pretentious and condescending without realizing it, and I love every minute of it. And I love Emma for the same reasons. So hopefully people will enjoy that in Emmett as well.
Yeah, I feel like it does get lost in the discourse a lot how annoying Emma is, even though Jane did have those intentions with her.
I know everyone's like, she's my favorite and so relatable. I'm like, you think she's relatable?
Oh no.
You might be problematic. I love, love, love Emma because she is this sort of like condescending know-it-all. And like, in all fairness, in high school, so was I. Today, maybe I still am, but it was a lot of fun to write that. And it also sort of jives with my other YA contemporary works that aren't that are like, high school works as opposed to Lion's Legacy, which is an adventure, which are Camp and Jack of Hearts, because I think in each of those I'm sort of taking a stereotype about gay people that I experienced growing up. So in Jack, there's sort of the like slutty femme guy, and in Camp, there's the way too much theater kid. And now in Emmett, there's the condescending prep. And those were sort of like the options for being gay growing up. Like, they were all sort of problematic and, the bad gay ideas that I was told, what gay people were growing up. And in each of them, even though I am not taking away from their like bad, I put that in quotes, quality, I am humanizing them, I hope. And that to me is exciting and fun.
Yes, I think so. It's very fun, and I think there is something to be said for presenting, like, I don't know, like diverse characters who are annoying, you know, because
Yeah,
we,
no, I love a problematic gay. I love a messy
yeah.
gay. Like, let gay teens be just as messy as straight teens. Certainly, we have plenty of books about messy straight teens.
And I guess that is sort of like the tough thing about like representation in general, you know, is that like when we're talking about like one character representing a people, that burdens that character with a lot of responsibility, you know? And so maybe they can't be as messy as they could if they didn't have like the weight of those expectations. So I think it's like a really great argument just for having like lots and lots and lots of representation so that you can have like messy, annoying people, you know, and like they don't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's definitely something that happens to pretty much every, fictional teenager that isn't a straight white dude, like almost, you know, women, people of color, black people, indigenous people, queer people, almost all of them, like there will be someone who comes along and be like, this is not good representation of this group, and like define good. So
yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's realistic, you know, like, because there are, yeah, like, it's just, like, it's great, like, and it's really fun to get inside the heads of those characters, too, I think, you know?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun for me, too. I mean, with Jack of Hearts, which came out, you know, back in 2018, I remember I met a librarian from Texas, and she told me she read the book, and she was like, I thought I was going to hate this, and, like, you know, because this is the type of person who, like, I would never, like, approve of. But by the end of the book, even though I knew I would not like approve of this person in real life, I really felt for them. Mm-hmm. Like I understood them and I was rooting for them to be happy, even if their version of happy is nothing I would ever want anyone's to be. And so that to me is like a big accomplishment.
That's a huge accomplishment, right? To be like, I don't necessarily agree with you, but like
I see your humanity.
Yes. Yeah. Like maybe, and maybe before, like I didn't, but like, I don't know. That's very powerful to me to be like, people can be as complex and messy as they are and still be okay. Be people, you know, like that's great.
Exactly. That's all I really want is for people to see the humanity in these characters and then hopefully in people around them in the real world afterwards, you know, yeah. History and humanity. There we go.
Great theme for the year, and
I know, I need a t-shirt.
Thank you so much for coming and talking about these books with us. I'm so excited.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely. Thank you for having me again.
Oh, you're so welcome. Listeners, so check out all of these books. Let's go through them again and like do some dates so everybody could be on the same page. So Lion's Legacy is May, coming up soon.
May 2nd. Yeah. A week from the day we're recording, in fact. I know, I'm a little nervous. So yeah, Lion's Legacy, Queer Indiana Jones, Ethics of Archaeology, Who Owns Queer History, May 2nd, Bell in the Fog, the follow-up to Lavender House, Queer Historical Mystery, Gay Military History, Gay Club History. That is October 7th, I think. And Emmett, contemporary queer retelling of Jane Austen's Emma, is November 10th, I think.
Excellent.
Unless it's October 10th and November 7th.
Well, I'll check them and I'll put them in the episode description.
Excellent.
Thank you again so much. This has been really cool.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. All right, listeners, we'll see you next time. It is time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.